Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. Word print or stylometry studies are an attempt to scientifically figure out who wrote a specific text. What does Dr. Brian Hales think of these studies? Do they explain ancient or modern authorship? We'll find out more in our next conversation with Dr. Brian Hales. Check it out.
There's evidence that the different authors have different voices, and I can see this. When I read Nephi, he's using a different phraseology than Mormon would, or Moroni, or perhaps Jacob, who wrote the least of the four. And so that's another thing that the author's got to keep in mind. Let's see, who's talking? Oh, it's Mormon. Okay, here's the kind of words he likes as they're going along.
Well, I know there have been a lot of word print studies trying to identify. And there was the Stanford study that said, Solomon Spaulding was the real author, whereas then the BYU guys used the same methodology, but they included a none of the above. And I think pretty much blew the Stanford guys out of the water on that. But it seems to me, and I don't know how you feel about word print studies, you know, there are a lot of BYU guys that say, well, there's 30 authors. We can show there's 30 different authors of the Book of Mormon. And then you have the Stanford guys that are like, no, it's Solomon Spaulding. Do you have any point of view on word print studies?
Well, they call them stylometrics. And I only include four. And mostly because as I'm reading those four authors, I can even detect some differences that a person making up the text would have to take into account. There are two studies that, as you said, are saying it was written by Joseph or by Spaulding or by Rigdon. And then there are studies by church members that show different authors and it couldn't be Joseph. I don't put a lot of stock into it, but again, I can tell a difference of how Nephi is writing in his books versus how Mormon is compiling in his section. Well,
so. And I will just say, if this was something that was a valid science, I think the FBI would have done that for Mark Hoffman. So,
well, and maybe you know, but I heard, who was it? Mark Hoffman had paid somebody $5,000 to try to break down the sentence structure of the Book of Mormon, and he'd made hundreds and hundreds of 3x5 cards that were cataloged. Who was that?
That was Brent Ashworth.
Brent. And so you can see that just to try to imitate 116 pages of the Book of Mormon, the amount of work Mark Hoffman was going to go to, the best forger of this era. And so I think he's showing us this wouldn't have been easy to do in the first place, let alone try to imitate it in the second place as Hoffman was maybe planning to do, because he could do Martin Harris's handwriting.
So, right.
But creating those actual sentences is a whole other ballgame rather than just writing.
The other interesting thing is, I don't know, maybe we can talk about this. You know, Mark used to kind of self-hypnotize himself. Shannon Flynn had mentioned that. And that was kind of how he got Emily Dickinson's muse. Was he kind of self-hypnotized himself? He read a bunch of Emily Dickinson poetry, and then he's like, I can do this. I'm going to pretend I'm Emily Dickinson. And I still remember Brent said, it was the worst Emily Dickinson poem I'd ever read.
Oh, was it really?
But it did fool a lot of experts. The Sotheby's sold the poem thinking it was legitimate.
Really?
And then Brent came back and said, I saw that poem in 1984. So that's kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah. Well, Hoffman was very skilled.
Yeah.
But the difficulty he had producing the actual text could be an indicator to us how difficult it would have been for Joseph Smith to produce the actual text, even if handwriting isn't part of the equation. So the Book of Mormon has 208 named characters, and each one of these persons wouldn't have made it themselves up. Joseph would have had to commit some cognitive energy to each one. Admittedly, they kind of flow into the story and then flow out. But again, they would have been something he would have had to consider. There's 45 social geographic groups that are mentioned throughout. Some are just mentioned once. Some are mentioned hundreds of times. There's two genealogies. One is 30 generations long. That's Ether. It's recounted in chapter 1 and then recounted backwards throughout the rest of the chapter. And then you've got the other genealogy, which is mostly those that are holding the records, that starts with the Lehi and Nephi. And those are kept very consistent. It's one more thing to think about while you're dictating to keep all of these things consistent. You know, one of the really weird things about the Book of Mormon is that God has over 100 different references. God is referred to in 100 different ways. There's 100 different names for God and Christ. And again, if you're making this up on the fly or even doing it ahead of time, it seems to me this would be something you'd have to spend a little time anticipating. An interesting thing is the geographic references. Of course, there it starts in the Old World. And we can test what the Book of Mormon says, and people have done that, because if you go south east of Jerusalem for many years, you come to a place that they found is called Nahum on mm-hmm. old maps. And then if you go directly eastward, you're going to hit the coastline where there are lush wadis that correspond to Bountiful. And we don't have to spend a lot of time on this. I know Nahum is something that's very controversial, but it shouldn't be, because when you look at the dimensions that are mentioned there, it's a bullseye hit for Joseph. You go down, there's a place called Nahum, and then you go over, and there's a place that corresponds to Bountiful. So lots of people have talked about that. But again, something else Joseph included in the Book of Mormon, if he were the author, that seems to be right on. Now, the Promised Land would be a fictional land if Joseph is making this up on his own. There are over 150 locations mentioned and over 400 different references to movements or geographical locations. So again, this is another thing Joseph had to keep in his head, and there might be one or two that are off. It's debatable, but the rest are all straight on, and that's a lot of movement and in an area that didn't have a map in front of him for him. There's ecological references, a monetary system. There's over 100 chronological references. And there are three chronology systems. There's leaving from Jerusalem in 600 BC. And then you've got the reign of the judges that they're going from. And then, of course, once we get the sign of Christ's birth, that's another one. So you've got three different systems of chronology that are kept totally straight. The next two are fun. There's 77 storylines. And some of them are fairly complex. And I've got them all on a chart. Again, each one of these storylines is something he would have probably had to think of ahead of time. Okay, we've got choices. Joseph could make the storyline up and memorize it, or make it up and write it down on a manuscript that nobody's ever seen or heard of. And stuck it in his hat. Or he could have made it up ahead of time and then stored it in his memory. But again, keep in mind all the things that he's got to store in this memory. And how good is anyone's memory anyway? Joseph wasn't dumb. Let me make that point. He was intelligent. He was. But he wasn't. He had no experience in dictating long books. And so there's no training. There's no learning curve for him. We see this just coming out of nowhere where Joseph is producing this. There's 63 major sermons, and some of them are long. Alma 5 has 42 questions. So do we think Joseph thought up all 42 questions ahead of time and memorized them? Or do we think that he made them up on the fly? Again, it's
Well, let me throw this out there. This is a case. Because a lot of people say, well, Joseph was just regurgitating a lot of the sermons of the day. Could he have gone to a Methodist sermon and then repeated what the preacher said?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And what we find are what I call mini explanations. And this is really, really popular with the naturalists, is they'll come up with a mini explanation for one little part of it and then assume that they've kind of explained the whole. Could that have happened, what you just said? Well, possibly for some of them, but these are complicated sermons that even if you heard a complicated sermon doesn't mean you have rote memorization, and Joseph didn't by any stretch. We know that when Joseph tried to learn Hebrew in 1835-36, okay, It was a class. He worked really hard. He studied outside of class. They hired Joshua Satius, mm-hmm. and he came for 7 weeks and trained everybody. And Joseph worked so hard. Guess who the number one student was?
W.W. Phelps.
No, he was one of the good students. It was Orson Pratt.
Okay.
And Orson Pratt got a certificate from Satius, Satius saying that he was good enough to teach it. Joseph Smith got a certificate that said if he continues, he will become proficient in it. So even though if Joseph had this incredible memory, we would have probably thought him capable of really absorbing the Hebrew even better than Orson Pratt did. And so we don't find in the historical record a Joseph that has this super memory. And language, learning language is very much dependent upon memory. You talked earlier about the formal headings. There are 21, and that's where they're chapter headings or they're book headings.
In the 1830 edition.
Yeah, and Bill Davis calls those heads. And there's 21, but there's also 121 editorial promises. This is where the text says, we will talk about something in the future. And then they go ahead and they have to come back to it. And you could argue, well, this is an outline of where you're going, but it's also a memory burden of where you must go. And so is it helping or would it be hurting as you're going through and having to remember all of these other elements in the dictation? There are 24 internal historical sources mentioned, like the brass plates and the 24 plates and different epistles and even some written sermons and things. And then we're surprised to find a discussion of olive tree husbandry and warfare tactics and biblical law that seemed to be beyond anything Joseph would have learned in school or learned from the Bible. And so it would have taken some specialized research in order to include that element. So as we look at this list of the literary characteristics here, we find a really complex book that to dictate with all of these characteristics would not be easy. Would take, in fact, we could argue that there's no genius that's created a book with these types of characteristics that's even a fifth as long as the Book of Mormon. And why is that? Well, even geniuses prefer to allow an editorial process. They aren't so smart that they can dictate final draft sentences in their first oral draft. And that, in my mind, with all of the things that we've talked about and the difficulties, the most difficult thing Joseph Smith ever did, if he did things completely naturally, if he wasn't a prophet, the most difficult thing he did was to create these, wordsmith these final draft sentences in real time. And if you want to understand what that means, we don't need Oliver Cowdery. Just get your cell phone out and use the voice to text app. And in that, you can dictate text messages. And Royal Skousen tells us that Joseph would dictate blocks of at least 20 to 30 words to someone who's going to line them up one right after another as they receive the text message. And then you include your stories and your people and your plots and your sermons, and you dictate these before you hit send. Go ahead and correct grammar, because Joseph came back and corrected some grammar. But then you have to do this 10,000 times, or until you get up to around 270,000 words. You can't rearrange a single sentence or even a single phrase or clause. And that gives each of us an opportunity to kind of understand the magnitude of difficulty that it would have been if Joseph was doing this naturally. And so I appreciate you letting me go through all of this, but I started when I was doing my polygamy research believing Joseph couldn't have done it. When I get all the facts out there, again, let's be transparent with what skills would be needed and compare them to what skills did Joseph Smith have in 1829. And I've made a little graph here, and it just shows that I think the oratory and compositional skills that someone would need to dictate the Book of Mormon in 3 months would be fairly high. We go to the historical record, and we don't find that Joseph had those. So I sense that there is a gap, and it's a gap that I hope that we can acknowledge, whether we believe or we don't believe, this gap between the historical record and what we would expect. And so when I was in England, have you ever been to England?
I have.
Have you ridden on the subways?
Mind the gap.
Mind the gap. Yeah, and there's a gap between the subway and the platform, and you don't want to stick your foot in there. You don't want to drop something down there. So they say, mind the gap. We must have heard it 100 times during the week that we were there. But I've kind of taken that in. If we mind the gap, let's acknowledge it's there, or if somebody thinks it's not there, then tell us why they think that and defend that position, and we're all ears. We'd love to hear it. But if there is a gap there, maybe the next phase would be for the naturalist to explain, you know, how they see that gap and its possible significance.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Brian Hales. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about anachronisms in the Book of Mormon. Is that a gap to be worried about?
Well, for me, I think anachronisms are the weakest criticism of the Book of Mormon for several reasons.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe for just $5 a month at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and you can hear the entire interview before everybody else. If you'd like to watch the entire video for just $8 a month, you can either subscribe on YouTube, Patreon, or my website, gospeltangents.com. Just click the yellow subscribe button, and I'll add you to our Gospel Tangents Insiders group so that you can see entire videos. For those interested in a PDF transcript, you can subscribe at either Patreon or on my website. For just $10 a month, I'll send you a PDF as soon as it's complete. If you'd like a copy of the paperback as well as a PDF, just sign up for $20 a month at either Patreon or my website, gospeltangents.com. Of course, you can buy individual transcripts at amazon.com and just do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview, and you can see all the things that we have there. Don't forget to support Gospel Tangents with an awesome t-shirt like one of these. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. Get our latest updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Also, you can get our Twitter updates at gospeltangents. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got more of our great videos. Thanks again.